much famous. May Allah bless his soul. Jamadi al-Thani 12/14/21 is the day that he passed away, and he's buried in the holy shrine in vicinity of the tomb of Lady Masuma, in the holy shrine of Hazrat Masuma in the city of Qom. May Allah bless his soul, and may the people and all Muslims all around the world benefit from the books of the late Ayatollah Mirza Ali Ahmadi Mianiji. Sheikh Mahtavi, thank you very much.
You're most
and also Sheikh Zia Inia, thank you very much, brother.
You're most welcome.
It was thank very you. Kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners and audience, for listening to this episode of the program. The teacher, do not forget us in your du'as, supplications, and the morning ceremonies that you held for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam during the month of Muharram. You can visit our website at parstoday.com/en and download for free our previous episodes on this program, The Teacher. Also, you can visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page under the title Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah. Assalamu alaikum ya Abu Abdullah.
I don't fear if from your cradle you depart. You sleep in the deepest oceans of my heart. But if for only a second from me you each ocean in my heart would be torn apart.
He said, I'm going to come. And then I said, make sure you tell your mum now quickly and tell her to get your brothers and stuff. And she said, okay, cool, see you later. And then I said to her, see you later. And then put the phone down. That was the last time I spoke to her.
We could see people at the windows. Yeah, it's such something that stays with you forever. It stays etched on your mind. You can't remove it. It's awful.
Our children have experienced things that other children that are in a war zone have experienced. They saw people that were jumping out of windows, and then people that were in fire, like running out of the building. They remember the smell, the smoke, all of that.
No one has to go through this sort of pain again. Never, ever.
Grenfell Tower was a death trap because it was safer before it was refurbished.
They covered the building in essentially solid petrol.
The Conservative majority here at the council constructed policies to get rid of those people that were seen as a cost on the housing benefit.
Seeing us as troublemakers and a threat.
They would have much rather that community not be in that borough.
Institutional racism has been the elephant in the room. It's an uncomfortable truth for a lot of people, because we like to think that society has progressed.
If no one goes to prison for this at all, then as far as I'm concerned, people have gotten away with murder.
The Grenfell Tower Fire. Part 1. This is the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea, the wealthiest borough in the whole of the United Kingdom. It is home to the Kensington Palace, luxury department stores such as Harrods, and many celebrities and notable political figures. It is also home to one of the greatest peacetime disasters in the UK since the Second World War, the Grenfell Tower Fire.
Well, that concludes the Phase 1 hearings. And we shall be in touch in due course to let you know when we're going to sit again.
The public inquiry into the fire has now ended its first phase, with the second phase unlikely to start until 2020. Peter and myself. many people gave some shocking testimonies during the past few months, including firefighters as well as survivors.
He looked like he was just sleeping, where the babies do. You know, at that moment, we felt like our hearts had broken. And it had. But at least we were able to hold him.
Marcio Gomez is the father of the youngest victim of the Grenfell fire, an unborn baby named Logan. He led his family of four to a miraculous escape from the 21st floor.
It was pitch black, smoke. You couldn't breathe. As soon as you open the door, you just get this woof of black smoke just come in. And it was very overpowering. We got out at 3:30, give or take, purely because we had to. The fire had come through the bedroom window, and my bedroom was on fire at that point. So I was lucky enough to spot it coming in. And when it did come in, I immediately closed my door. And I turned around to the girls and our neighbour, who was obviously still there with us. And I said, the fire's reached our flat. We need to get out. And it's now or never. There was bodies on the stairwell. Because it was pitch black, you couldn't see who or the faces. Obviously, I know it was my neighbours from around the tower, but don't know who they were. But it was difficult stepping and tripping over the bodies that were in the stairwell.
More than a year after the fire, Marcio still breaks into tears when asked about Logan.
I was devastated.
My wife, she's made of the hardest material I know, and without her strength and courage, I would not be here.
Sadly, Marcio's next-door neighbours, the El Wahabi family, didn't make it alive. It was the holy month of Ramadan in the Muslim calendar. The night before, the family had broken their fast and prayed together. Nur Huda, their only daughter, was revising for her GCSE exams. Her last phone conversation was with her closest friend, Yusra.
She sounded calm when she was speaking to me. She's just woken up. Me and my mum woke her up because my mum and me called her. So she said, oh, you and your mum have been calling me. And I said to her, there's a fire in your block. I said, it's spreading a bit higher. I said, it's about on the fourth floor now. I said, tell your mum and, like, hurry up. I said, just come out. I said, because it's going a bit higher. And I said, I don't know if it's going to reach your floor or it's going to go into your flat. And she's like, oh, okay, then. And I said, hurry up, then. She's like, okay, cool. She's like, I'm going to come. And then I said, make sure you tell your mum now quickly and tell her to get your brothers and stuff. And she said, okay, cool, see you later. And then I said to her, see you later. And then put the phone down. That was the last time I spoke to her.
Nur Huda and her family were last seen trying to escape. But at the staircase, they were told to go back up by other fleeing residents. The order had come from the firefighters for people to stay put within their flats.
Well, I think the whole basis of fire protection in a building like Grenfell, but not just that high on many buildings, is what we call compartmentation. That the idea should be that a fire should be contained within what we call the compartment of origin, which might be a room or a flat. so that therefore there should be fire-resisting walls, fire-resisting floor, ceiling, doors and windows and so on, and that should stop the fire from spreading outside of where it starts. That allows the occupants to escape from the flat and to make their way out of the building, and firefighters to then enter the building with firefighting equipment and to extinguish the fire in that flat of origin. And that's the whole basis of what is described as stay put. That is a policy of the building, not necessarily of the fire service, but the fire service operates on the basis of that advice that has been given to residents. And clearly what happened at Grenfell is that whole system that should restrict the fire to the original flat completely and utterly failed.
Can you tell us, first of all, whether you've ever had any training or experience of revoking stay put?
No, I haven't.
Right. So there's no training and no experience as far as you're personally concerned. No. Do you know whether in the brigade there was, as at the 14th of June 2017, any training on how to go about revoking stay put?
Not that I was aware of.
No.
An official report has now confirmed that the failure of the London Fire Brigade to evacuate the building immediately made all the difference between life and death. The initial cause of the fire was a malfunctioning fridge freezer in flat 16 on the fourth floor. The first call to the fire services was made at 54 minutes past midnight.
Fire brigade?
Yeah, hello, hi, in the fire, flat 16 Greenfield Tower.
Sorry, a fire where?
Flat 16 Greenfield Tower. In the fridge.
Right, hang on.
Flat 16 Greenfield Tower. It's the fourth floor.
Right, okay.
Quick.
They're on their way already. Yes, I know it's burning, but they are on their way. You've only just called. As long as you're okay.
15 minutes later, the firefighters enter flat 16 and attempt to eliminate the fire. The yellow glow in this thermal video is the fire which can be seen next to the kitchen window. Just over 10 minutes later, the fire in the kitchen was fully extinguished. Sadly, it was too little, too late, and the fire had already reached the extremely flammable cladding that covered the tower. Within minutes, the fire had raced up the exterior of the building. By 1:30 a.m., it reached the top floors. Antonio Roncolato was a resident on the 10th floor of Grenfell Tower. He had just come back from Italy the night before and gone to bed at 10 p.m. for an early start the next day. He was woken up at 1:40 a.m. by a phone call from his son Christopher, who was returning home from a late shift at work.
So when I saw the picture of the tower, I said, my God, what is going on here? So it was really, that one really shook me and it woke me up. And then I realized, oh, you know, I'm in trouble here. So I got dressed, I tried to go out, but as I touched the door to try to assess the situation, the door was very hot, was very, very warm. I opened a little bit. I had smoke coming right into my eyes, into my face. I closed the door promptly, and I could not see anything. It was totally black, very hot, very acrid smoke. And then I went to the bathroom. I rinsed my face a little bit in my eyes. And then I said, okay, now, you know, we have to, you know, you have to really, you cannot make any mistake. You have to analyze exactly and focus what you're doing, because that could be the last mistakes you do if you do a mistake now. So I was continuously in touch with Christopher, and the fire brigade, the firemen downstairs told me, stay put, somebody's coming to get you.
Antonio was the second to last person rescued by the firefighters. He survived in his flat for almost 5 hours.
I knew that was not my day. I knew I would make it alive. I knew I had a strong conviction and faith that, yes, they told me to stay put and they would come and get me. They did. And the only thing is that my son, Christopher, because don't forget, more than 4 hours, me inside pacing around and Christopher, my son, downstairs looking at the tower burning, a torch getting bigger and bigger, you know, brighter and brighter. So basically Christopher was very stressed. And at one stage I had to reassure him, Christopher, be cool, be calm, because he was worried about me. He was death worried about me. And I said, because this is not my day, and I'm going to make it out alive. Don't you worry.
Many people like Antonio were given hope by the firefighters that they would be rescued. They started waving white towels from their windows to make sure their flats are noticed from outside.
From what I know now, it was very difficult to reach the top floors. Although I would have preferred knowing that that was the case, rather than them telling me, we're making you a priority, we're sending somebody up. If they knew they weren't going to reach, at least tell me that you're not going to reach. I could have tried something different. I could have tried to leave earlier. You know, there's so many scenarios.
For the already traumatized survivors of Grenfell, a horrifying rehousing process awaited.
Well, we spent 3 weeks in the hospital. King's College Hospital. My bedroom was a hospital bed, basically. My wife and my daughters were all put into into a coma because they were trying to get rid of all the poisoning that was inside them. They were diagnosed and treated for cyanide poisoning. The Portuguese consulate was actually there the following day, so they were very quick to respond and to get there. The council or anybody like that, a whole week went past, they still weren't there.
The grieving families had to fight the council for their right to a new home, a council that was already found to have £274 million in its reserves in the immediate aftermath of the fire. Yusra lived in Grenfell Walk at the foot of the tower. Following the fire, she was evacuated along with her family, who were placed in a hotel for almost a year.
Some people think that because you're in a hotel, they think that it's cool because, oh, a hotel, you get this and you get stuff, and it's nothing, it's the complete opposite. It's, you can imagine living in your bedroom and then your parents' bedroom, and that's where a family of 5 people had to live. That's the situation we had to live. We had to wash the dishes in the bath because the sinks were always getting blocked, and we couldn't, because obviously it was a bathroom sink, so we couldn't wash the dishes in there. So we had to get in the bath. We had to send washing off to my nan's house. We washed the clothes in our nan's house. You're literally overnight been put into something that's the size of your bedroom, and you've been put in there to live with the whole family, and it's all cramped up and everything. It's completely different. It drives you crazy. You feel like you're in a room where you're just trapped and you can't get out of it, and it's literally, you cannot get out of it until, you know, obviously until we're housed and stuff. So it's horrible. It's nothing like some people are thinking.
You do everything in that room. You eat in that room. The girls have to do their homework on the bed. You watch TV on your bed. It's just a hotel room. It's made for short stays, 1 or 2 nights, maybe even a week. You know, you hang up a few shirts if you're going to work and that kind of thing. But to live inside it, it's very, very difficult. It's the basics that you realise that you miss. You know, just making some toast, putting some butter on the toast. You can't even do that. It's quite difficult.
The Prime Minister, Theresa May, had promised that all the affected families would be rehoused within 3 weeks. More than a year after the fire, there are still over 50 families living in hotels, with a further 40 residing in temporary accommodations. The rehousing process has been described as truly shameful.
Why is it taking so long? You know, I just can't imagine why it is taking such a long time just to find people homes.
Someone needs to step up, because they said 3 weeks everyone's going to be housed, but there's still people not housed today. I don't understand. What's that hard?
This was not the first time fire had broken out at Grenfell. Over the 3 decades that Antonio and his son had lived in the tower, they had witnessed multiple other fires. Before some major refurbishments to the tower in 2014, all such incidents were contained within a single flat. This time, however, it was a whole different story.
I think Grenfell Tower was a death trap because the evidence suggests it was safer before it was regenerated or refurbished. All the fire safety measures which would have been designed into the building when it was built in 1974 had been compromised by what was done to the building. So the fire lifts didn't work, the smoke extraction system didn't work, the fire doors were not appropriate, the windows had failed, and of course the cladding that had been applied meant that fire, which should not be allowed to spread up the side of an or outside of a building, did indeed very rapidly spread up the outside of the building. So on every front, the fire protection measures, as we call them, were completely failing.
They had a choice between more fire-resistant cladding and less fire-resistant cladding. What they actually chose was the less fire-resistant cladding, which was at a cheaper price, marginally cheaper, because the project was around just under £10 million to do.
I just can't believe how government, central government or local government, can allow a building to be covered in what's essentially petrol, you know, in a more solid form. I know there's austerity measures and everything, you know, that everybody's trying to save money in some way or form. But you should not be allowed to save money if you're putting people in danger, you know, or at risk. And basically that's what it did.
To this day, the company that made the combustible cladding still denies responsibility and blames the failing of the windows for the rapid spread of the fire. The US-based giant Arconic describes the claddings as being, at most, a contributing factor. Professor Lawrence Harwood of the University of Reading claims to know why the aluminium cladding is the main factor to blame for the rapid spread of fire. His theory is based around the violent reaction of aluminium with water.
It's a well-known fact that aluminium reacts very violently with water, and it occurred to me that the Celotex foam insulation, which was exposed to the atmosphere, could well, over time, have absorbed atmospheric moisture from rain, and then started adding things together that the moisture from the Celotex foam impinging on hot aluminium could then start a reaction that would then generate a lot of heat and generate hydrogen, which would again burn, generating more heat and regenerating water. And then at some point the polyethylene could become exposed, that would then burn and produce yet more water, and at that point you'd get a runaway reaction and the fire would spread very rapidly. As soon as water hits the aluminium surface, there's a huge energy spike. A lot of energy is released as a consequence of now the water reacting with aluminium. So it's counterintuitive that water would make matters worse in that sense, but small amounts of water, so that they don't cool down the aluminium but react with it to cause this violent exotherm, will cause this reaction to occur.
It is this interaction of the water released from the insulating foam that ultimately turned the aluminium cladding into fuel for the rapid spread of fire.
The chemistry is well-known chemistry. It's undergraduate level chemistry. The question is how people put two and two together. I've spoken to several architects and building engineers, and they all have problems comprehending the idea that aluminium itself can burn violently, particularly when it reacts with water. And this, the whole idea that that water makes matters worse. Again, people seem to have trouble with this. But in fact, the aluminium, unlike wood burning in air, the aluminium burns in the water, and it takes the oxygen out of the water. And that's why you get hydrogen, which itself burns.
The findings have been handed over to the inquiry in form of a letter. While his letter has been acknowledged, no one from the inquiry has followed up on his request to provide evidence.
I think it's very important that further work be carried out into this hypothesis in order that we can get to the truth of the matter, for the sake of the people who died, for the sake of their families, and in order to ensure that such a situation never happens again. We really do need to get to the truth of the matter.
The risk of cladding and the risk of fire spread as a result of cladding is a key issue that needs to be looked at. We believe that it should have been known about. We made warnings a long time ago, as long as 1999, following a previous fire. There have been other cladding fires around the world, and it's our view that people in authority, in the both the fire service but at government level, should have been aware of this risk and could have been therefore planning for it. What was very clear is that on the ground it wasn't widely known within the fire service. There had been no plans or alterations to procedures as a result of that.
The people who make those decisions to put flammable cladding on a building, you know what you're doing. You actually know what you're doing. When you do that, the possibility has been created. Now, you can only do that in certain places. You can't do that everywhere. That can only happen in the place that nobody cares about. That could only happen in the place where, you know, you see those people as lesser than you, that you don't have the same levels of concern that you'd have for on top of the hill, yeah, up at the town hall or whatever, that you do for the residents of Lancaster West or North Kensington. Yeah, that's a contempt. That's something that's inbuilt into the culture of the people that are making these decisions. Those ones that are in the positions of power and privilege and abuse it because they can. So, you know, when they're doing it, it's a decision that's not based upon any kind of moral compass. It's based upon their own personal gain.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, True Worship. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. The intention and spirit behind the deed, the manner in which it is accomplished, and its quality determine its real value, not its appearance and quantity, so to speak. Imam Ali alayhi salam emphasizes to Kumail that one should pay attention to the spirit of a deed instead of its appearance and quantity, because the final aim of these good deeds is man's education, development, and improvement, which depends on the sincerity with which he performs them. Imam Ali alayhi salam said to Kumail, O Kumail, it is not sufficient merely to pray and fast and pay alms. It is more important that your prayer and your deeds are performed before Allah with a pure heart and humility. Sometimes when we are serving Islam, when we're trying to do something good, we get so focused on the appearance and the apparent setup and in some cases the quantity, the frequency of things, and the volume of things, that we do not pay attention to the quality of the action being carried out. Sometimes its essence, it gets killed along the process. You know, one of the good examples is these ceremonies we have for Prophet and Ahlul Bayt. Sometimes we see that, you know, we're so indulged into making them beautiful and pretty, which is good, we should. We should try to make the appearance good too. But then, more important was the spirit of Prophet and Ahlul Bayt and their movement. And sometimes we miss out on presenting that spirit to our audiences. Welcome back, dear listeners. We are talking about true worship in today's discussion, and we said that more than the quantity and the appearance of an action, what is more important is the intention of the doer and keeping alive the essence of that action, the real quality of that action. And it is not we who are saying it, it is Amirul Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salam, who is emphasizing on this. Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam said that actions are to be performed with, number one, pure heart, and number two, humility. So let's try to dig a bit deeper into what a pure heart means. Well, the pure heart isn't necessarily referring to a believer who commits no sins or who is perfect. No, that's not necessarily the case. It is referring to a heart that is free of associating partners with Allah, that believes in Allah without doubt, and that believes in the hereafter without an iota of a doubt. The pure heart is about pure intentions. Similarly, let's talk a bit about humility, the second thing that Amirul Mu'mineen has mentioned, for all the believers to practice in their everyday lifestyle. Well, humility comes from knowing about God and recognizing His greatness, venerating Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, loving Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and being in awe of Him. And it comes from knowing about oneself and one's own faults and weaknesses and deficiencies and discrepancies. You know, we are full of shortcomings. If we realize our shortcomings, the result is we can have humility. We can have decency. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Hurricane Ida made landfall in southern Louisiana on Sunday, August 29th, as one of the most powerful hurricanes to ever hit the U.S. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sharon Zhang, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Climate Crises Converge as Wildfire Burns West and Hurricane Pummels South. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Hurricane Ida made landfall in southern Louisiana on Sunday, August 29th, as one of the most powerful hurricanes to ever hit the U.S. It has knocked out power to the hundreds of thousands of residents of New Orleans and over 1 million in Louisiana, and has caused at least one death so far. Scientists say that the climate crisis has, without a doubt, made Ida more intense as higher water temperatures offshore act as fuel to hurricanes' fire. Greenhouse gases resulting from human activity have contributed to a rise in average water temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico by 3 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit since the late 20th century. The Category 4 storm has so far blown entire roofs off buildings, devastated the Louisiana town of Jean Lafitte, and overwhelmed hospitals already filled with COVID patients. Ida's storm surge was so strong as it made landfall that the hurricane actually reversed the flow of the Mississippi River, something that experts say is extremely rare. With the threat of levee failure hanging over Louisiana, the hurricane, since downgraded to a tropical storm, is headed into Mississippi. Though many residents evacuated the region before the storm, many others, unable to evacuate, have been left behind. Some people simply cannot afford the cost associated with seeking shelter out of the storm or may not have reliable access to transportation but out of the area, such as a car. Other populations, such as incarcerated people, have no choice either way. As Ida blasted through Louisiana, the climate crisis intensified blazes across the country. Wildfire Caldor has engulfed hundreds of homes in its wake as it has moved across eastern California in the past 2 weeks. It now threatens Lake Tahoe, where residents on the California side have been ordered to evacuate. The Caldor fire has been particularly hard to contain. Firefighters have pushed back their estimated date for containment of the fire to September 8. As the Caldor fire blazes on, the Dixie fire, just 65 miles to the north, is well into its second month of burning. At nearly 50% containment and with over 770,000 acres burnt so far, the Dixie fire is the second largest fire in California history, beaten only by the August complex fire from last year. California's weather has become drier for longer periods over the past decades as global warming and climate disruption have lengthened the wildfire season and pushed winter rains further and further back in the year. It has wreaked havoc on the state, where 6 of the 7 largest fires in the state, including the Dixie fire, have occurred over the past year or so. It's unclear if all of these disasters were caused directly by the climate crisis, but they were surely fueled by it. As climate scientists warn of dire consequences of the world continues on its current path, the western part of the U.S. has experienced record heat waves, making July 2021 the hottest month in recorded history on Earth. The converging climate disasters come as officials struggle to contain the pandemic scouring the country and contend with massive unrest in Afghanistan. Two crises that may seem unrelated but have actually been exacerbated by the climate crisis. Climate change helps spread infectious diseases, scientists have warned for years. There is evidence that air pollution, including that of burning fossil fuels, has worsened COVID outcomes for frontline communities living in areas that bear the brunt of increased air pollution. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, the Taliban has exploited the economic devastation and serious resource shortages brought on by the twin effects of drought and flooding caused by climate change to successfully overthrow the government that was propped up by the U.S. Climate unrest has been on full display through this year and the last, but nearly all of these problems exacerbate each other, solidifying the so-called threat multiplier effect of the climate crisis. California, for instance, cruelly forces incarcerated people to be on the front line of firefighting when the wildfire season rolls around, paying them such absurdly low rates that it has been likened to slavery. But with so many prisons ravaged by the pandemic, the state has had fewer incarcerated bodies to help fight the fires, making it harder to contain the blazes as they rage on.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Aysel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayed Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. I genuinely believe that these topics that we are delving into are extremely, extremely important. Although I understand that we are being as brief as possible and as concise as possible, or else it will take a very, very long time for me to finish the book should I want to expand on each area. And I think this part that we are entering into, the part of how to deal with others, is something that we really need to spend some time on. And inshallah, my dear brothers and sisters out there will be able to expand themselves by reading, by learning, by gaining skills that would enable you to positively interact with others. And I think whether it is interacting with fellow Muslims, interacting in a positive way with those who you might be at conflict with ideologically or even in principle on whatever case it may be, it's always going to be something that you need to vitally return back to learn and pick up some pointers as to how you deal with it. You know, in the previous episode that we had, how do we deal with alim? What kind of mannerism must be observed when it comes to alim? And before that, we were talking about how do you deal with an enemy? And I think these are very important things that, you know, all of us are one way or another going to experience in our lives. And this leads me to, you know, this particular point at hand, roaming around the area of ilm. We know that ilm is valued. We know that al-alim is valued. We know that al-muta'allim is valued. And we've spoken about these three. How about al-mu'allim, the teacher of knowledge? And we might be able to understand this in the broader sense, or any teacher, whether it be a teacher of maths, a teacher of language, any teacher who it may be, or whether it be a teacher exclusively of religion. I understand from the riwayat from Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam that it is in the broader sense the value of a muallim, or someone who teaches you.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
We know the very famous hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, that you might think it's a level of exaggeration as to how we need to honor and revere the status of our mu'allim. But when we really look into it, we can understand that we will always, always be in debt to someone who teaches us anything. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, "Man 'allamani harfan sayyarani or sirtu lahu 'abda." Someone who teaches me a letter, I will become, or I become their servant. Sirtu lahu 'abda, I become their servant. We will always be in debt to someone who teaches us, whether that atmosphere of teaching be in a classroom or whether it be someone who, you know, is guiding you, someone who is giving you pieces of information that you really need to learn as far as your life skills, as far as religious understanding, whatever it may be, you know, the hadith from our imams, alayhim salam, it says, "Man laysa halaka man laysa lahu murshidan yarshiduhu," someone who doesn't have a murshid, a guide, an instructor, a teacher, to teach them, to guide them, will perish. So all of us, young or old, will always need someone to give us that boost that we need in education, especially in the area of education, of course. And when you are young, when you are in the schoolyard, when you are in a classroom, and you do see other people mucking around or disrespecting the teacher, always remember what it is that your religion says to you, and that is that you need to show the highest level of respect to your teacher, because a teacher is like a parent. And this is what we can derive from what it is that our religion says to us. As for the religious side of teaching, there is a hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, where he says, "Allahumma arham khulafai," and he repeats that three times. "Oh Allah, have mercy, shower your mercy on my successors." Qila ya Rasulullah, wa man khulafauka? Oh Rasulullah, he was asked, "Who are your successors?" And he says, "Alladhina yuballighuna hadithi wa sunnati," those who propagate, those who share, those who teach my teachings, my statements, and my tradition. "Thumma yu'allimunaha ummati," and teach my ummah these pieces of information and propagation. What we can understand from this particular hadith is that there is a difference between tabligh, conveying a message, and ta'lim, teaching a lesson, or teaching instructions from a religion. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala ashrafi khalqillahi Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane. And you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Short wave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.